The Americans with Disabilities Act turns 25. Sunday marks the 25th anniversary of the day President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act, a wide-ranging civil rights law that prohibits discrimination based on disability. The ADA protects people with both physical and mental disabilities and applies to many aspects of life, including accessibility, employment, transportation, and public accommodations. In the past 25 years, multiple ADA cases have reached the United States Supreme Court, including an important case from Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about the evolution of the Americans with Disabilities Act, how it's enforced here in Maine, how businesses have responded to it, how it's changed the lives of people with disabilities, and what's still left undone. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. When President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law in 1990, he called that day, quote, an Independence Day that is long overdue. What does this law mean for Americans now, 25 years later? How has it changed and what's still left to be done? With me today, Kristen Aiello. She is Managing Attorney for Disability Rights Maine. Amy Sneerson is the Executive Director of the Maine Human Rights Commission. Dennis Fitzgibbons is the Executive Director of Alpha One. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the ADA? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send us a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. I understand Sunday is the actual anniversary. Kristen Aiello, how did the ADA come about 25 years ago?
Well, we're marking the passage of the ADA on July 26th, this coming Sunday. But it really began far before that date in 1990, 25 years ago. It really began with parents who stood up for their kids being excluded from schools. It began when independent living movement challenged the idea that people had to be institutionalized. And it began when individuals just were basically shut out of different aspects of society simply because of their disability. They began forming civil rights groups similar to groups formed on behalf of people based on gender or on race. And the movement started many years. So the movement started many years before the passage of the ADA in 1990. The disability community began educating people and gathering stories about the need for broader protections really in earnest in 1988 when they introduced hearings regarding the ADA and the need for the ADA. At the first hearings, Senator Harkin talked about his brother who was deaf, Senator Kennedy about his son who had a leg amputation, and Senator Coelho about his own epilepsy. Other individuals with disabilities from all around the country testified. A Vietnam veteran who came back from the war who was paralyzed talked about how he couldn't get out of his housing project or off the bus or even off a curb. A woman with cerebral palsy testified that a theater wouldn't let her in because of her disability. So based on all of this testimony, Congress introduced the Americans with Disabilities Act, which ultimately passed on July 26, 1990, 25 years ago. George Bush is credited, certainly, for signing this historic law and the members of Congress for passing it. But there are so many unsung heroes who are responsible for passing this comprehensive, the most sweeping disability rights civil law for people with disabilities.
All right. Amy, who does the ADA apply to and who does it not apply to?
That's a great question. It applies in a lot of different areas of people's lives. It applies to employers. But not all employers. Employers that have 15 employees are over. It applies to state and local governments, to public accommodations, which is a sort of broad category that includes anything that is open to the public, whether it's privately or publicly owned. And that means restaurants, hotels, privately owned buses. It could mean movie theaters, dentists, lawyers, doctors, hospitals. It applies to some other things that people don't really know about, like telecommunications. Most of us don't give a second thought to picking up the phone line, but if you're someone who's deaf, then the ADA is what made the phone system accessible to you through TTYs, which were sort of text-based telephones, but now through an entirely different system called the relay system. The other part of the ADA that's interesting is that there's also sort of a standalone provision that says that if someone asserts their rights under the ADA, they can't be retaliated against.
So, and also it applies to people not only with physical disabilities, but also mental disabilities.
Right. So I just described sort of one side of who it applies to, of who's a covered entity under the ADA. But on the flip side of who can seek the protections of the ADA, you're exactly right. It's someone with a disability. It can be physical. It can be mental. The ADA has a very specific description of who's included of having a disability, and that's a definition that's been broadened over the years. Originally, the definition was interpreted very narrowly by courts, and in 2008, the Congress passed the ADA Amendments Act to broaden that definition to very specifically include people who were being excluded.
Dennis Fitzgibbons, in your view, has the ADA done its job?
Well, that's a great question as well, Jennifer. Yes and no would be the answer. I think what many people with disabilities find frustrating about the ADA is the slow progress that has occurred over 25 years, where I think many of us back in 1990 when the law was passed really expected to see significant change in a short period of time. And yet, here we are 25 years later. The employment of people with disabilities is as bad as it ever was. There are still as many people not working. I think it's three times or four times the rate of the greater population of people who can't find jobs that are pay well, pay enough to live on, livable wage, and to find employers who will hire them.
So, do you believe it's because the ADA doesn't have enough teeth, or it's the way it was written, or what is the reason that we're not moving faster?
I think part of it is not having enough teeth. I think generally speaking, the ADA is driven by individual complaints, usually from a person with a disability who is expected to step forward and make a complaint of some type. And that is very difficult for people to do if they don't feel like they have the power to do so or the support to do so. Maine's a great example of where it's difficult in a very rural state. If you live in a small community and you know everybody in town, and maybe even relatives or friends own businesses that are not compliant, it's very hard to lodge a complaint against someone that you know or you may even live with, for that matter. It's small-town America here in Maine. And even in larger communities like Portland, it's still difficult because people just don't know their rights completely, or they don't know the law, they don't know the process, and the people you complain to often don't know the process either. There's a lot of confusion about who's supposed to approve a building design or who's supposed to sign off on that completion.
Still today, 25 years later. So an architect or a developer may not have clear guidelines.
Exactly. Well, they have the guidelines, but they don't know the guidelines. The guidelines exist. There's strong guidelines around ADA compliance or the Maine Human Rights Act, both. But it's a matter of what people know they're supposed to comply with. And again, there's no ADA police, so to speak, that goes out and says, okay, you can or you can't do this. They're supposed to be doing the permitting. They're supposed to be doing the inspections and things like that. But many of them are confused about what their role is in that process.
So we have people that inspect restaurants, who inspect nail salons,
right,
but we don't have people that inspect public accommodations for ADA accessibility.
Exactly. We've been talking about that a lot recently, too, because to open a new building, you would have to bring in a plumber to inspect the plumbing. You'd have to bring in an electrician to make sure that all the safety codes are made that way and all the other issues that have to be complied with or inspected. But they don't have a rule to bring in, say, a well-trained architect or engineer to look at the actual project upon completion to make sure it's in full compliance.
Kristen,
it would be a great thing to add.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add to Dennis's really important point about employment of people with disabilities. It's way lower than it should be. One of the problems that has occurred with the ADA, when it was first signed into law or born, there was great promise associated with the ADA. In fact, it was called an Emancipation Proclamation for People with Disabilities, and it was the hope that people would, and expectation that people with disabilities would be protected in similar ways to other protected classes. But that didn't happen, and I will tell you a very startling statistic. And under Title I of the ADA, the employment provisions, 97% of employment cases are lost when, in 2008, Congress was alarmed by this and looking at and taking testimony about the failure of the ADA. And you wonder, well, what was the problem? How could that possibly be? If there are employment protections for people with disabilities, how could that plaintiffs have been losing cases at the rate of 97%? One of the findings of Congress was that when the courts were reviewing ADA cases or taking up ADA cases, they were interpreting the definition of disability very, very narrowly. For example, they wouldn't take what are called mitigating measures into account when they looked at whether or not someone with a disability had a disability. In fact, there was a man in Texas, for example, who had a prosthetic leg, and the court said that he was not disabled because he had a leg that allowed him to walk. He didn't have a substantial limitation in a major life activity because his leg allowed him to walk. He wasn't alone. There were people with multiple sclerosis, with what was formerly known as mental retardation, now known as intellectual disability. There were people with bipolar, epilepsy, breast cancer. All of these plaintiffs were kicked out of court before even hearing the merits of their claim from the period of the passage of the ADA until 2008, when Congress said enough. And it was a bipartisan Congress almost unanimously passing the ADA Amendments Act because both sides of the aisle were alarmed by this and passed the act. They didn't change the definition of disability itself, but they gave a very stern warning to federal courts that the ADA is not to be interpreted so narrowly, and that was not the intention of Congress.
And Kristen Aiello, I understand you had a role in that change, and Maine had a role in that change.
Well, I can't take too much credit, but I've been doing this work for a long time, and I was very fortunate to have a couple of cases that that were reported up. One was a voting rights case that in 2001, I don't know if our if people remember when there was a referendum that came out with regard to the question of whether or not people under guardianship because of mental illness should be able to vote. And twice the voters of Maine declined to get rid of that provision out of the Maine Constitution. So I was fortunate to represent three plaintiffs who were not allowed to vote but who were very able to vote. So we brought a claim under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we were fortunate to have had a very good result from that. Judge Single in the federal court here in Maine found that that provision was a violation of equal protection, a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and a violation of due process. And from that, the United States Supreme Court actually used that case in the case of Tennessee v. Lane to show how individuals with disabilities are still being discriminated against despite the passage of the ADA, and they're still facing discrimination, even in such areas so fundamental as voting.
Amy Sneerson, if there's somebody who has a case in Maine, does it come before the Maine Human Rights Commission? Does it go before court? What happens to it?
Right. So the process is that if someone wants to sue, file a complaint related to a disability discrimination, they are essentially required to file with the Maine Human Rights Commission first in order to preserve all of their remedies. People have 300 days under the Maine Human Rights Act that's different than what people have under the ADA. So it's a more generous provision if they file with us. They have 180 days if they file. Kristen is saying no to me. She says no.
But first it comes to the Maine Human Rights Commission.
First it comes to the Maine Human Rights Commission. And when they file with us, we investigate. And if someone wants to opt out of our process, they have to wait 180 days. Yes, I know I'm right about that. and then if we haven't completed our investigation, they can opt out and go to court from there. If people want to wait for us to finish our investigation, then we give them the result. And if they, whether they agree or disagree, they can go to court thereafter.
Okay. Well, believe it or not, we have to take a break already. We will do that. And when we come back, we'll have some of your comments and questions about the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Midcoast Energy Systems, providing energy-efficient products and services to homes and businesses in the Midcoast, midcoastenergysystems.com, and Ollie's Trolley, offering narrated daily tours of Acadia National Park. Tickets and more information at ollie'strolley.com.
On the next Fresh Air, a follow-up to our discussion about upspeak and vocal fry. Young men and women, particularly women, who have those vocal patterns are often accused of sounding irritating and lacking authority. What's going on? We'll talk with a linguist who studies language and gender, a speech and language pathologist, and a journalist who's been criticized for her voice. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. MPBN is a media sponsor of the Portland Museum of Art's summer exhibition, Director's Cut, Selections from the Maine Art Museum Trail. Director's Cut highlights artists and artworks that embody the quintessentially Maine ideals of fierce independence, innovation, and self-sufficiency, as well as a strength of character that is built from admiration and respect for the rugged and unspoiled qualities of this land. MPBN members are entitled to 10% off admission to the Portland Museum of Art during this exhibition, now through September 20th. Please visit mpbn.net and click on Events for more information.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. With me in the studio, Amy Sneerson, who is Executive Director of the Maine Human Rights Commission. Dennis Fitzgibbons is the Executive Director of Alpha One. And Kristen Aiello is a Managing Attorney for Disability Rights Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. But first, we're going to turn to Dana Connors, who is the president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce. Dana, thank you for calling in from vacation.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. It's a very important subject, and I'm pleased to be able to join you.
Dana, I remember 25 years ago when the ADA was first passed, there was some worry covered in the national media that the business community thought it might be too burdensome. Has that turned out to be the case here in Maine for businesses?
Well, I think that, again, I think you've got a very distinguished panel who are very well informed on this issue. And I think it's, from my point of view, I think it's fair to say that there was that apprehension. I don't think it's been totally removed, but I would say that progress has been made, but it's probably, to use an expression, it's probably a race that has no finish line. I mean, it's one that we need to be very vigilant about, be very informative on, and introduce it to business continuously. And I think what we have found in partnership with Department of Health and Human Services and Department of Labor here in the state, that we've taken this issue from a little different perspective, not to dismiss the obligations under it, but we have created what's called Maine Leadership Network, Business Leadership Network. It's a national effort, but our chapter here in Maine has to introduce to our business community a challenge that we have. We refer to it as the workforce challenge. I mean, it's a challenge indeed, but it's a tremendous opportunity. And people with disabilities provide for the business community a tremendous opportunity. I think it's fair to say, and your panel would either back this up or take issue with it, we have more people with disabilities in the state of Maine than national average, but we employ fewer. And why is that so? Well, it could be for a number of reasons, but we've held workshops around the state because we believe that the workforce challenge is one of skill that is being worked on, but it's also one of supply. I mean, we need more people in the workforce, and it's been well publicized as to why that's so, an aging population, a flat population, and so forth. People with disabilities provide for us a tremendous opportunity, and you're finding great examples around the state. For example, L.L. Bean, Procter & Gamble, Tambrands, their Flexi Center. You're finding many companies that have opened the door, and what they find are some very redeeming, positive results, not only on the social side of justice and providing opportunity for people with disabilities, but also on the employment side, because these are people tremendously grateful, very loyal, very productive, and it's one of those very rewarding circumstances. Our efforts with this partnership is to bring those who have success in the business community together with those who are interested to try to answer some of the questions and provide for them places to go for answers so that they can take advantage. I mean, our workforce needs in terms of supply of people depends on our better utilization of people with disabilities.
And Dana, I understand the Maine State Chamber of Commerce just held a conference for businesses in Maine on how to better serve people with disabilities, how to find better, you know, employment, more meaningful employment for them, and also some of the legal issues. But as you were speaking, I want to let Dennis Fitzgibbons come in here, because you were nodding when Dana said that Maine has more people with disabilities than the national average, but employs fewer. Why do you, Dennis, think that is?
Well, I think part of it's because we're now the oldest state in the country, and the population is aging at a rapid clip compared to other states. So, and as you age, you have a greater chance of acquiring a disability. That's just how it works. That's right. And so with more older people, you have more incidence of disability. And I think to get to carry this further, I was just delighted to hear Dana use the word that this is an opportunity to employ more people with disabilities, because there are fewer people in the workforce, and we can't really let anyone stay on the sidelines and not be employed and included in, you know, the economy here in Maine. And that's just wonderful news. I think there is progress being made, and that's what it's going to take for employment, is that businesses take this approach rather than advocates continuing to knock on the door or hammer on the wall to move this further.
And Dana, I want to ask you as well, though, doing research for this program this morning, I came across some troubling statistics that people feel as though after the Americans with Disabilities Act passed, that fewer people became employed because employers were afraid. They were afraid to hire with people with disabilities because they were afraid they would open themselves up to legal action, to scrutiny. Did you hear stories of that happening in Maine, and do you still hear stories of that happening?
Well, I can't say I hear stories, but intuitively, you know that there are instances where people, you don't know what you don't know, and that they're concerned that if I do employ, there's an added legal liability, there's a costly responsibility. And you break down those barriers by using companies like Volt Packaging, small company in the Biddeford Sock Quarry that's done outstanding work. Walgreens on a national level has been a tremendous leader. And as I said, you've got everyone an inspiring time, uplifting experience. Go to Tambrands, Procter Gamble, and Auburn, and be witness to the actual productivity that comes from employing people with disabilities. The more we sit down and provide information for people, the perception, the concern is removed and in its place.
All right.
Find a willingness to employ people. And that sounds maybe overly naive, but I don't think so. That's exactly what we're experiencing. And it's a slow road to progress and success, but it's an effort worth pursuing. And the evidence is so overwhelmingly positive when you do that it's hard to deny or ignore, and we shouldn't.
Well, Dana Connors, thanks so much for calling in. Dana is president of the Maine State Chamber of Commerce. Amy Sneerson, you wanted to chime in?
Yeah.
No, I
go ahead.
It's interesting hearing about employment, particularly because at the Maine Human Rights Commission, that's the largest area of complaints that we get by far. And among employment complaints, disability is the largest basis cited for complaints. So we spend a lot of time talking at our agency about complaints related to employment by people who have disabilities. And I was just thinking about the types of complaints that we get. And it's wonderful to hear about all the progress that's being made. But I have to say that my daily job is to look at the areas where there is not as much progress being made, or maybe it's more subtle. And it seems like among employees with disabilities, the biggest issue is how to help their employer understand what they need to accommodate their disability. And I think requesting an accommodation. That's one of the most amazing things that the ADA did, was allow employees with people with disabilities to ask that their disability be accommodated, not just to have the door shut in their face, but to say to their employer, I need you to talk with me about how to make sure I can stay in the workforce. The ADA requires an employer to actually talk back and forth interactively with the employee. And that's such a tremendous tool that has allowed people to stay in the workforce. But it's tricky. And I think when Dana and you were talking about employers' hesitations about what might happen if they take on employees, it is tricky. But I think the increased productivity and the positive outcomes that you guys were talking about, is there's a right way to do it. And the Maine Human Rights Commission and Alpha One and the Disability Rights Maine are all folks who are out there trying to help people understand the right way to support employees with disabilities.
Okay, going to the phones now, and we're going to start with Zach, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Zach. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for this show, and thank you to the guests for all their amazing, important work. It always struck me that one of the strengths of the Americans with Disability Act is that the term disability embraces so many different things, disabilities that people are born with and disabilities that people acquire, physical disabilities, developmental disabilities. But it also seems like that must be a challenge for lawyers and advocates when you're dealing with so many different actions and different restrictions that are all come within this term of disabilities. So I wondered whether any of the guests had any thoughts about that issue.
Kristen?
Sure. Thanks for the question, Zach. I think one of the most remarkable things about the ADA is its definition of disability, because one of the more challenging things when the civil rights movement was really coming together around disability, and make no mistake that disability is a civil rights movement, just like any other civil rights movement. But that one of the more unique things about the disability rights movement is what Zach refers to, which is just so many different types of disabilities. And the definition of disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act is three prongs. One is a substantial limitation on a major life activity, which means, for example, if someone is deaf, they are substantially limited in hearing. The second definition is if someone has a record of disability. And the third is if someone's regarded as disability. They may not have an actual disability, but actually I thought of that definition when our caller, Dana, was just talking about employers who may be afraid of a liability or if it's costly. If employers are making adverse employment decisions because they're concerned about those things, it very well may be that those are unfounded concerns that are based on stereotype. That would be constituted or regarded as claim. None of us want to be judged on a stereotype. None of us want to be judged by our gender or our sexual orientation or our disability. The real issue is the individual in the employment situation, for example, qualified to do the job? So somehow the ADA, based on the Rehabilitation Act, which was passed in 1974, has been able to bring in all these very unique conditions that are unique to every person, because not everyone with bipolar disorder is the same, obviously. So a cornerstone of the ADA is that individualized assessment. So you look at someone not just by their label. We all know that that's not right, but really if they're qualified to do a job.
Has there been pushback? Have there been people say it's too broad and it protects too many people?
Well, interestingly, Congress unanimously passed the ADA Restoration Act. Both Republicans, Democrats almost unanimously said Congress intends this to be much broader. It should come under the protection. More people should be included. In Maine in 2007, the year before the ADA was passed, Maine revised its definition of disability. And that was almost unanimous vote in the Maine legislature to broaden the definition similarly. And incidentally, when the ADA was passed, those who were negotiating the ADA had the Maine Human Rights Act on the table, and pieces of the Maine Human Rights Act were integrated into the ADA. So that's another way that Maine has sort of influenced the ADA. But I think that evidence from Congress and the Maine legislature by people representing the public is that they want protections for people with disabilities. They also want to know that people are going to be judged by their ability to do a job, for example, not by their label. I think that's almost universal.
Okay. Thanks, Zach, for your question. We're going to head to Monroe and Kathy. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hi. I just had a quick question about qualifying for disability. If you never worked in the private sector just for the state and you became disabled, are you still allowed, are you still qualified to apply for disability if you've never paid into Social Security?
You know, Kathy, this panel, I don't know. Do any of you know the answer? We're really more talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act, not about disability law. Go ahead, Kristen.
It sounds like, Kathy, you might be referring to social SSDI, that would be a different definition that's applied, but it's a common misunderstanding. It can get very confusing because there are different definitions of disability depending on what statute we're talking about.
So I'm sorry about that, Kathy. Hopefully we'll have a future show and address that issue. Going to Brunswick and Ray. Hi, Ray. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing? Two quick questions and a request for a comment. The first question is the United States the only country with a law like ADA? Second question is, will IDEA ever be fully funded? And the request for a comment is based on something that somebody said to me with respect to ADA. And that is 80% of the services that are available are only available for the first 20% of a person's life, meaning once you reach age 22, you're pretty much on your own.
Dennis Fitzgibbons, are you willing to take a shot at this? And first, explain to us, do one of you know what IDEA is? Okay, yes. Amy Sneerson.
So the IDEA is the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act. It is a law originally passed in the 70s that's been reactivated many times that provides special education and related services to children with qualifying disabilities. And the caller is correct in that it applies up until the time that either the student turns 20 or soon after high school graduation. So what happens is there's sort of a cliff. IDEA provides a tremendous amount of services available through the public school system funding. But once the child graduates or ages out, there's not a replacement for that in the public support system network.
Dennis?
Yeah, getting to the other question about, or the observation about, is the United States the only country that has this type of a law? We certainly were the first, and we've had a great influence around the world on other nations and how they pursue disability rights. But I'm not sure any of those rights are yet comparable in other countries as they are in the U.S. And so we've actually exported disability rights around the world. And there's a growing movement now internationally around the rights of people with disabilities. In fact, last year, for I think the second time, the Senate voted not to, I forget the term for it, but to endorse a treaty for the civil rights of people with disabilities around the world. And we'll be back again at the national level to try to advocate for that. But even though we've had the leadership worldwide, now we are not willing to endorse the worldwide document and treaty.
Oh, okay. Well, Ray, thanks for your question. And guess what? We have to take another break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, committed to boosting recycling rates statewide through its One Bin, Zero Sort program, Casella, giving resources new life. Woodland Senior Living, assisted living and memory care with a new memory care facility in Lewiston opening this fall, woodlandsmaine.com. And St. Joseph's College, offering the CPA workshop series, register by August 18th at sjcme.edu.
Climate One is changing the conversation about energy, economy, and the environment. Our next program explores how the U.S. government is tackling the climate challenge. Both the Obama and the Bush administrations have faced the thorny question of how to promote economic and environmental health. And how can we bring the China powerhouse to the climate table? Join our host, Greg Dalton, for the next Climate One.
And you can join us for that following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock. Many businesses and organizations in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on the MPBN radio service. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting MPBN, either on MPBN radio or MPBN television, or both, please visit our website, mpbn.net. Click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions and contact information, or call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. And of course, thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Americans with Disabilities Act turns 25. With me in our studio, Dennis Fitzgibbons, the executive director of Alpha One, Kristen Aiello, a managing attorney for Disability Rights Maine, and Amy Sneerson, the executive director of the Maine Human Rights Commission. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Before we go back to the calls, I want to talk to Dennis Fitzgibbons for just a moment. This is the radio, so our audience can't see that you are in a wheelchair. And I wanted to ask you about your own experience. Were you in a wheelchair before the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, and how has your life changed because of it?
Well, I was in a wheelchair long before the ADA was passed. In fact, there were very few access laws back when I was injured in 1969. So I've seen a lot of progression in both federal and state legislation and rights protections for people with disabilities. I can remember when there were very few places where with a wheelchair you could get into anywhere. It included colleges that I tried to attend. It included stores, retail establishments, restaurants, et cetera. The world was extremely limited. And then later, as things improved little by little and we started to raise a family, then we were affected by how I could access my kids' education when things were happening in the schools or in town, et cetera. And little by little, there has been incremental progress in the inclusion opportunities that come along. I think there has been, taking the long view, there's been significant change and positive change. I certainly get frustrated still running into things that shouldn't happen at this point in time after 25 years. But I think if we remember to take the long view, then we know that eventually the ADA will be implemented, but it is going to take time, and we just need to keep pushing and striving to make sure that it's monitored, and people are looking at all the ins and outs to make sure people, their rights are held firm, and we continue to make that progress. It takes folks like us on the panel, but it also takes the general public to start to take the long view as well, and to change attitudes that they have about disability, going from people that need to be taken care of, which we are not, to people who should be, included in our communities and be able to really enjoy all the benefits that everyone else does as a Maine citizen or as a U.S. citizen.
We're going to go to Lynn in Scarborough. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a 72-year-old veteran who's also got some disabilities. I have a service dog. And in my quest for getting my service dog admission in several different places, I was rebuffed and threatened, in fact. The first one that comes to mind is the VA. I went to VA, and I was going there for optical and hearing assistance. I go to an ophthalmologist and a hearing specialist, and my dog went with me. Not a problem. About 3 months after I started going in and out of the building, I get a nasty gram from two individuals up there that say, my dog can't come in the building.
Lynn, how long ago was this?
How about 6 months, 8 months? I've got all the paperwork to tell me.
Wow. Amy Sneerson, you don't look surprised.
I'm not surprised because service animals are a tremendous source of complaints, both from people with disabilities and from people who work at and own public accommodations or hospitals. The VA is a federal agency that is not subject to the ADA. They have their own separate complaint process. The federal government is pretty much the only entity that's not covered under the ADA. I want to mention for other places that you may go, there is the Maine Human Rights Act, which is the state analog to the ADA, and it covers a lot of places in Maine that might not otherwise be covered by the ADA. You can file a complaint with the Maine Human Rights Commission. That's the law. The Maine Human Rights Act is the law that the Maine Human Rights Commission enforces. the ADA is actually enforced by the United States Department of Justice.
Mm. Thanks for calling, Lynn, and telling us your story. We're going to move on to Wells and John. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for the show. It's great. ADA is very close to my heart. As a Maine registered architect, I work in large projects that all have to comply with the design guidelines of the ADA. But my comment is not really about that. It's more about those projects in the built world that don't necessarily have to conform to ADA, existing projects, small projects, where it doesn't seem like there's the initiative or the will to make reasonable accommodations for people with limitations. And I'd like some feedback about that. A simple point being like no levers on bathroom doors. It's a very easy thing to do, but nobody does it. So maybe your panel could opine on that.
Kristen Aiello.
Thank you for that input, John. We feel the same frustration. There, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, for buildings that were constructed, new construction especially, after 1992, they're required to follow the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act and its implementing regulations, as I'm sure you know them well. And we feel the same frustration when, for example, you might have a big box store that was constructed well after 1992, and they have tons of boxes in the aisles, so someone who's using a wheelchair can't get through. It's making what should be an accessible place inaccessible. And also the lack of planning and thinking in terms of new building construction. We hear about it, we get calls at Disability Rights Maine about it, and we share the frustration. One thing about the Americans with Disabilities Act that I think is so compelling is the idea that we have made the world in many instances over time inaccessible. We've put stairs in when we could have put a ramp in. Fortunately, with the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, we've thought ahead. We've thought, you know, there's no reason why this should be inaccessible. We should be an inclusive society. And yet there are instances of it still happening. And I would just say people have options to file a charge with the Maine Human Rights Commission, with the Department of Justice, to call a private attorney or to call Disability Rights Maine, or before taking all those measures, simply go to the business, go to the place and say, gee, I've noticed that this isn't accessible and I think it should be. What can be done about this? And our best day is when we can work these situations out directly without having to undertake filing a complaint. But it is very frustrating when buildings are constructed to be inaccessible when they're required to have accessibility.
John, thanks for calling in. We have an email from Mr. Gray in Portland. What rights and resources do school students have under their 504 plans? I have a feeling we have to do a whole program with the answer to that. But Kristen, you want to give us a brief answer to that?
Sure. A 504 plan is a reference to the Rehabilitation Act, which gives individuals with disabilities or students with disabilities the right to accommodation, for example, in schools. They may not qualify under the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act. So Section 504 is a great option for kids, for example. There may be a student who needs physical accessibility who can invoke their rights under 504. It's hard to comment on any particular case or details, but the first step is talking with the teacher, talking with the school, and making the request for accommodation under Section 504. And hopefully it's granted and worked out, and if it's not, then a complaint could be filed if necessary.
And compliance is not consistent throughout the state of Maine, is it, Kristen?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Different school districts do a better job of helping students with disabilities than others.
That's true. I think that I primarily work in other aspects of society than education, but we get lots of complaints about different school districts not providing for accommodations for their students with disabilities. Some we hear about more than others. We do have a special education attorney who handles all those, and he'd be a better person to sort of share those details.
Okay. We're going to go to Charles in Brunswick. Hi, Charles. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a terrific program. I want to say I yield to no one in my admiration for the Americans with Disabilities Act and its objectives and its accomplishments. I did hear on NPR a an hour-long program, which Google won't describe for me, about the disabilities industry and the very large number of lawyers in particular who encourage people to say they have a disability and perhaps they have a borderline disability, and then to get them on disability. And all comments about how the Social Security Administration was unable to hear these cases seriously, and a lot of people wound up in a place where they didn't want to be, i.e. with a small income, but with no prospect of getting off disability and being able to resume a more normal life.
Okay, thank you, Charles. This is the second question we've had that has to do with a whole other area of disability law, and this is people who, quote-unquote, file for disability because they're unable to work because of their disability. But why did I bring it up in this way, Dennis, is that does this make it complicated for those who have a disability and are seeking work when there's this whole other world out there of people who are applying for disability because they say they can't work?
Well, I think it does make it difficult when, and I'm not hearing that it's people with disabilities so much as what I'm hearing from Charles is that it's attorneys who are sort of using this as a source of revenue to really work the system, so to speak. And I think that does make it difficult for those of us or those people with disabilities who rely on those systems when the time comes for either have SSDI or SSI as a support, income while they are either looking for work or working on their aspirations so they can return to work. So anything that sort of railroads these things in another direction or creates a bad image for people with disabilities as taking advantage of the system is not helpful. It's just discouraging for a lot of people when they have to put up with that.
Kristen.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I'm certainly not aware of attorneys who practice in that manner. If they did, there are bar rules that would address that. If cases are being brought that have zero merit, I'm certainly not aware of that happening here in Maine, at least. But I will say that sometimes we have concerns about Social Security disability. Because you have scenarios where, for example, students in school who are in special ed who are encouraged to apply for SSDI immediately after graduation from high school. And at Disability Rights Maine, we really disagree with that aspect. We think everyone should be able to seek work. We think kids with disabilities should be counseled on their options for work in whatever capacity they can do. And too often we think that people with disabilities are told, no, we don't think you can work. You should apply for SSDI, either by physicians or by schools or what have you. And it may be certainly with all the best intentions. We just want to protect this person. We're concerned that they have a disability and they're not able to work. But to us, that's not allowing for the real important idea that every life should have the opportunity to be lived independently. Everyone should have the opportunity to work. I don't know about anyone else, but I wouldn't want anyone to tell me, well, we think because of your label, we have concerns about your ability to work, so we want you to go on public, to go on some sort of public benefit. We think that's wrong. We think the public needs to change the way it thinks about that, and we certainly encourage everyone to look at their options to live up to their potential, because as far as we know, we all only have one life.
Amy Sneerson.
I would just add that what Kristen was just saying reminded me at the time the ADA was passed, I think there was a comment that this was intended to challenge the tyranny of low expectations. And that's a lot of what I'm hearing in Charles's comments and all of us are trying to combat is the stereotypes that people apply to people with disabilities, that we don't want folks with disabilities to take those on as their own. So that's what the ADA is intended to do, and we hope that that's what it will keep on doing.
And I think what you're told, especially as a child or a high school student, is what is very often what you end up living out. Oh, that's what I am, and I guess I can't. That is a very tragic situation for any human being to be told out of the gate that they can't. We think everyone should have the opportunity in society, in life, either in education, in work, in housing, to be able to live independently and support themselves.
So really talking about a culture shift, Dennis.
Yeah, and those negative images are reinforced all the time, and it's sort of insidious. It happens in many ways. It happens through the media. It happens through or movies and how people with disabilities are portrayed, but this idea of low expectations is just rampant, because if you are coming out of high school or something like that, and the first thing you're supposed to do is to get on a public benefit, which then limits how much you can work and limits you in so many other ways, it just creates this lifetime of low expectations. And once you're into that system, which is meant to support people but not permanently, it does often become permanent, because then you're just really to give it up is then means giving up your insurance, which until recently you couldn't have if you'd gave up that SSDI or SSI. Now with the ACA and the idea of the exclusion of secondary conditions or pre-existing conditions is great, and that ought to help move things in employment too. But getting, when you're told over and over again that you can't do something or you're not able to do something, you start to assume.
You start to believe it.
That starts to be you, and it shouldn't be how we treat people at all.
Well, thank you. That's great last words. Dennis Fitzgibbons, Executive Director, Alpha One, Amy Sneerson, the Executive Director of the Maine Human Rights Commission, and Kristen Aiello, Managing Attorney for Disability Rights Maine. Thank you all for being here. John Keimel ran the board today. Our volunteer Tommy Bazarian answered your calls, and we had additional production help from our other intern, Moses Small. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Don't forget, 1 week from today, it is the Maine Calling Book Club. Be sure and read Maine author Monica Wood's short story collection, Ernie's Ark. And join us. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on MPBN.